This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Not that long ago, when there was a conversation about problematic drugs sweeping Indiana, that conversation was usually about meth. The opioid epidemic, though, took a lot of attention away from the drug, but meth use never really stopped. It's actually been increasing in popularity. Crackdowns on the sale of items used to make meth have made finding meth labs more rare for law enforcement. But the demand for meth is still high and still being met. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can leave us a voicemail, call us at 866-476-3881, and we'll try to get your question or comment into the conversation. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me now is Matt Oliver. Matt is from Community Howard Regional Health in Kokomo, where he works as Executive Director of Operations for Outpatient Behavioral Health. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us about this.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
So we're talking about this in part because there's been a pretty significant change in the popularity of meth, at least in Indiana in recent years. Can you tell us what we know based on data and other sources that have looked into this?
Sure. Every year we look at, what are the top diagnostic classes that we're seeing in terms of the individuals that we're serving. And we evaluate that for a number of reasons. We report out to county commissioners what we're seeing in our local counties that we serve. We also look for treatment programming needs. And what was striking to me, as I looked over the past year or so, the change in our methamphetamine use, because we're seeing more and more individuals coming into our clinics needing addiction services that are struggling more with methamphetamine. And when I look at this over 2018-2019, it's pretty clear that there's been a shift. Like, more specifically, when I look at, July of 2017 through June of 2018, I see we were much heavier in working with individuals struggling with heroin or other opiate painkiller medications. About 45% of the individuals coming in were struggling more with some sort of opiate-related substance use disorder. When I'm looking at, a year and a half later, we're seeing that that's gone from 45% down to 28%. And actually, our lead category of individuals coming in with different challenges with the recovery, now the methamphetamine stimulant class is actually up to 32.5%. And that was, for that 2017-28 timeframe, we were only about just under 20%. And so you really saw a pretty big uptick in really what we're seeing with methamphetamine. And as we've talked with, law enforcement, we've talked with county health officials, when we talk with our clients, we're hearing that while certainly opiates are, particularly heroin and heroin laced with fentanyl and other types of painkillers, those are still a challenge to our community. There is an emerging second issue, which is meth is making a comeback.
Matt, were you on the job when meth was more in the news, back when, rural meth labs were sort of being busted right and left and were sort of dotting the rural Indiana landscape?
I was. I'm a trained psychologist, and I've been doing clinical practice and administration since 2005, for really the past 15 years or so. So when meth labs were much more of a problem 10 years ago, five years ago, I was a part of that. So we had lots of people very concerned about, policy or what shopping for ingredients, and then certainly rural meth labs. And we saw people struggling with meth, and that had kind of died down a little bit over more recent years to be more reflective of what we've known more commonly as the opiate epidemic.
Well,
so I've been around a while.
So has meth use then, is it back to those levels, or are you seeing the problems associated with meth use being even worse now than they were then, when it was getting a lot more attention?
Well, that's a good question. That's probably a complicated question to answer easily. But I'll say this. As it's more dangerous to use fentanyl-laced, heroin. And now that the availability and even the purity has increased for meth, and certainly the price has gone down so that meth is very cheap and readily available, I think it's become more of a substitute. And the tricky elements going on with meth today is it's a little different than what was manufactured locally. A lot of the meth coming into the market today is coming up from labs in Mexico. So it's pretty pure, but it also can be cut with fentanyl or other kinds of additives. And so it's not just straight meth. And so when people talk about overdose risk, if you're taking a look at pure methamphetamine versus pure heroin, opiates are going to be much more likely to result in overdose. And so there is some general sense that meth is safer than opiates or heroin. But meth on today's markets can be much trickier because it's coming from a black market. It's coming from illicit drug dealers, and it's coming from places that you don't know exactly what is in that substance. So it's not necessarily safer, but it's definitely cheaper and readily available and probably cheaper and easier to get than what you had seen in the markets when you go back to earlier meth days, if that answers your question.
It does. And I'm wondering, since there are different factors that make, say, opiates addictive versus meth. You know, with opiates, there are a number of physical dependencies and things like that. What is it about meth that makes meth addictive?
Meth is addictive because meth affects your brain, and particularly a neurotransmitter called dopamine that's responsible for pleasure and energy. Meth has qualities about it that, when you take it, it causes a flooding of dopamine within your brain, within your system. And what happens is your body tries to counterbalance this surge of dopamine, and it does it in a couple of ways. One is it reduces the amount of dopamine your body produces naturally. And so your ability to feel pleasure, or at least at peace, goes down. You start to feel more irritable and cranky. Now, when we talk about meth producing a rush of pleasure and energy, it's well beyond anything you can get naturally. It's well beyond, physical exercise, eating, sex. All of those produce a certain level of dopamine. When you do methamphetamine relative to a lot of other drugs, it's multiple folds more intense and higher. So it's an unnatural state of being. And so your body's going to naturally counteract to it. So it does it by reducing the amount of dopamine that your body's producing, and it reduces the number of receptors in your brain that'll even register dopamine because there's too much of it. And so what happens then is you go from a state of feeling high and good to crashing to feeling terrible. And what feeds the addiction, if you will, is that craving for just trying to get back to normal, because your body is making adjustments to an unnatural state. It's an unnatural substance. And so because of that, you don't feel right afterwards. You crave that high that you got when you initially started using substance, and eventually it just turns where you're trying to get meth or your drug of choice just to try to feel back to normal because of the biological changes that occur within your body.
And I have a limited knowledge of drug addiction, but to me, that sounds like a lot of drug addictions. Is there anything unique about meth and how it is addicting compared to other drugs?
Meth is one of the most addictive drugs because of its potency, because of the way it affects your body, the high and the physiological changes that are encountered because of the drug. It's more potent than some other drugs that might not be as habit-forming. And so, you know, all the different drugs have their different properties. Some affect different types of neurotransmitters or different chemicals, and they all have their different profiles. But methamphetamine as a drug element is definitely one of the most addictive drugs out there that's out there being abused.
And so how do you then treat that? How can you counteract that in people? It sounds pretty devastating.
It can be very devastating. It can be devastating physically to your body and your health, and certainly to relationships or, you know, in terms of being able to take care of yourself or working. And so, you know, treatment is definitely a common question that we get. It's like, how can I help my loved one or how can I help myself? And the truth is there are very good treatments out there. Addictions treatment, recovery treatment does work. And there's a lot of hope to be had if people will engage in that. And, you know, people have asked, you know, what is it about treatment that helps? A lot of times that's about structure and about accountability and support, as well as about thinking about what got me into using methamphetamine or other drugs in the first place. And so cognitive behavioral therapy, group therapy, peer support are all important parts of getting onto the path of recovery, making sure you've got a recovery community. All of those things make a dramatic difference if people will engage. And as they engage in treatment, they reduce use, they get better, and that's a great thing. But recovery is oftentimes a process because the different ingredients on helping people get better may be changing. And so, you know, depending on the amount of structure someone has, depending on the amount of support somebody has, that can all affect relapse. Some people have asked, you know, are there any drugs out there that are approved by the FDA for the treatment of methamphetamine? Currently, there's not a government-approved or FDA-approved medication like there has been for opiates or even alcohol. However, naltrexone is a drug that's been used to help with reduced cravings for alcohol and opiates, and it's found some preliminary findings that have been fairly promising. A group out of UCLA a few years ago published some findings that said that individuals who used naltrexone that were also given methamphetamine reported less response to the methamphetamine as well as less cravings. And so stay tuned for more on that, and hopefully we'll have more medications that can be helpful, because in terms of use, reducing those cravings can be a dramatic game changer.
Matt Oliver is Executive Director of Operations for Outpatient Behavioral Health at Community Howard Regional Health in Kokomo. Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Up next, we'll learn more about the rising popularity of meth in Indiana and hear from a DEA agent about why things are changing. As always, we'd love your questions and comments on this. Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. And our next conversation will be live, so leave us a quick voicemail. We'll do our best to get it on the show. Get us at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelsor. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelsor. Before we get back to our conversation on the rising popularity of meth, I want to quickly mention our last show. We end every week with the Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on some of the biggest Indiana headlines of the week. We also talk to an Indiana volunteer helping with the wildlife rescue effort in Australia as deadly wildfires sweep the continent. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In and look for our blue and black logo. Today we're talking about meth, why it's becoming more popular in Indiana, and how law enforcement and health officials are working to address it. As always, we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. In the studio now, we're joined by Michael Gannon. Michael is an assistant special agent for the Drug Enforcement Administration, or the DEA. Thanks for coming in, Michael.
Hey, thank you for having me, Matt.
We also have Dan Gordon, group supervisor for the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael, we'll start with you. You heard our conversation with Matt Oliver from Community Howard Regional Health in Kokomo in the last segment. And according to him and some reports, meth is becoming increasingly popular in Indiana, possibly even surpassing opioids in popularity. Is this a trend that the DEA is seeing as well?
Well, first of all, meth has really never gone away. It's always been a problem, and we've always done what we always do, conduct several meth investigations. And each year, we're seizing multi-hundred pounds of methamphetamine throughout the state. So the opioid crisis was such an epidemic throughout the whole country, and even here in parts of Indiana, that it probably brought attention to that. But meth has never gone away. And we're continuing to have meth cases on a daily, weekly basis. And we've had significant seizures throughout the whole year of 2019.
And meth, of course, got a lot of the attention back before the opioid epidemic kind of sucked all the oxygen out of the room, I guess, in one way or another, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was considered one time parts of Evansville. It was arguable whether that was the meth capital of the world. So, yeah, it's had a lot of attention, especially in the Midwest area.
But things are changing, as I understand it, on how you deal with it. We're not seeing as many production facilities, but we're seeing just as much, if not more, product in Indiana?
Oh, absolutely. The production is strictly coming from Mexico at this point. They're able to get the chemicals from China. They're able to have super labs that they're operating in Mexico, and they're producing ton quantities of methamphetamine. And then they're dispatching people to various parts of the U.S., and they're distributing tons of methamphetamine in our country. So the supply is there. And the potency is at the highest level it's been. We're seeing 95, 96, almost 100% purity with the crystal methamphetamine that's flooding our streets and our communities.
And this was different from the products that were being made by the users themselves in local meth labs.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I think most people are aware of the DEA and what they do. But, Dan, you work for what's called the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, I actually employed with DEA as well as a supervisory special agent, but I oversee the HIDA program. And again, as you just stated, it's High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area. So about I've been here about 6.5 years, supervise a task force group. Specifically, about 3 years ago, we took over a HIDA initiative. Its main focus is to target things like methamphetamine. Our specific initiatives right here in Marion County. So we deal with Marion County primarily and then some of the surrounding outlying areas. My group's made up of I've got a federal, state, and local partnerships. We have an IRS agent assigned. We've got about 5 IMPD detectives assigned to us. I've got a handful of agents as well. And Beech Grove is also here in Marion County. So there's roughly about 14 guys that are all part of that task force group. And again, mainly focusing right now on methamphetamine and heroin.
Is there such a thing as a typical bust? Are they all kind of the same, or are there distinct differences? What's the scale there?
Or the spectrum? Everything's a little bit different. Generally speaking, yeah, I think the way we approach the investigations may be similar. But every case has got a little twist of its own.
Are we busting people who are getting it out there, or are we busting users, or are they, as they used to be during the meth lab days, which are kind of gone now, one and the same?
No, because we're a federal task force, we primarily focus on the upper-level investigations, so we're not interested in the users. However, as I'm sure you can imagine, occasionally there are people that are using the product that they're distributing as well, but our main focus is upper level investigations. Those members, be it cartel members and that are here, that have infiltrated the Indianapolis area and that are bringing in drugs from primarily Mexico to the U.S.
Mike, any difference on how you look at that and how you handle it? How is it being approached?
Oh, no, we handle it the same exact way we work with one another. So the key is we do what we do best. We coordinate with our state and local and federal partners and our overseas offices, and we try to target the highest level drug traffickers there are. And we put all our resources together and we go out and make the best case we can to work it with the United States Attorney's Office and prosecute these people that are pouring poison into our communities and just have complete disregard for our citizens. So that's what we do, and that's what motivates us to do our job every day. You know, each and every day we're out there working as hard as we can with our state and local counterparts. We have people doing undercover operations, putting themselves at risk to try to make the community a safer place. You know, I live in this community. Dan lives in this community. We have kids in this community. And all we want to do is try to rid people of putting poison out on the streets. So that's what we do.
We have a voicemail message from Ariana in Muncie asking about other drugs that can be laced with meth. Let's listen to that now.
Hi, my name is Ariana. I live in Muncie, Indiana. I am wondering if you could touch maybe more on other drugs that are laced with meth, such as I hear a lot about MDMA, oftentimes being meth, and people purchasing it without realizing that it's meth. So I'm wondering if you have any more information about that and kind of what happens to those people that accidentally get addicted to meth because they didn't know that they were taking it. Thank you.
Mike, Ariana was asking about other drugs that can be laced with meth and how that could create new addicts. Are you seeing things like that?
Well, what I'd like to say about that for Ariana, it's a great question because, you know, before I worked in Indiana here, I worked almost 20 years in South Florida. And while I was working in South Florida, a lot of investigations that I personally had involved club drugs such as MDMA, ecstasy, or Molly. And what happens oftentimes, you go and you try to take an ecstasy pill and you don't realize that sometimes it's not 3/4 methylene dioxymethamphetamine. It could be just strictly methamphetamine in it. So it's like anything. When you're taking drugs, you do not know what a drug trafficker is putting into the drugs that you're using. They could put anything they want, and you have to understand, like, when it comes from source countries, usually the purity is at a much higher level. But when it gets broken down to two or three different distributors, they may put any type of cut in there because at the end of the day, all they care about is making money. They don't care if it's going to affect somebody's body or whatever. They just want their money. And the other thing, I'm really glad she asked that question because I want to really get this time to put out to everybody the issues that we're seeing right now with the opioids, with the M30s, the oxycodone type pills. I couldn't tell you throughout the country, we're seeing millions of pills that have fentanyl in them. So that's what people have to understand. If you have an opioid addiction as well, we're finding that they're putting the Mexican sources, they're putting fentanyl in that. And as we know, fentanyl is about 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine and heroin. So you're really exposing yourself when you're taking drugs on the black market because you don't know what people are mixing them with. And if you get about 2 milligrams of fentanyl, that you could die. You could overdose and die. So to answer her question, it isn't just methamphetamine that you have to worry about. It's any drugs. And we've seen mixtures where fentanyl is now in cocaine, obviously in heroin, and the opioids. So there's a lot of issues with going on getting drugs from people that just don't care about you.
Dan, we mentioned where this is coming from. We see that it's primarily coming from Mexico. What do we know about exactly where it might be coming from, the source?
So we focus on, you know, several of the major cartels down there in Mexico, and we can relate this back to, you know, a few of the different cartels that they have down there, at least the bulk of what's coming into the United States.
Are we talking about like super labs, like a few facilities that are kind of producing the meth that we're seeing here?
Absolutely. Bulk of what we see in here is coming out of these labs in Mexico.
Yeah. Anything to add on that?
Yeah, we're doing that every single day. We're targeting members of the Sinaloa cartel and CJNG cartel, Jalisco New Generation. So we're doing everything we can to coordinate with our Mexican offices and look for extradictions coming back and working the dope up to the highest levels we can.
So then when it starts here in Indiana, and again, here we're dealing with users. Yeah, we're dealing also with some lower level and mid-level distributors as well. But when it comes to busting it, I suppose, I guess, where do you start and then how does that progress?
Well, each case is different. You take the information that you're provided with and you use different investigative strategies that you have to use to make that case happen. But like anything we do, we try to take it as high up as we can to identify the source of the product. So at the end of the day, we don't settle for just like knocking off like an average guy. We try to work it up as high as we possibly can. And like I told you before, it was like a collaborative effort with a lot of different entities. And we do a lot of coordination with special operations divisions that we have in our overseas office and try to just take it as high as we can, any investigation.
Dan.
I think it's important, too, to just remind the public, look, any information they can continue to pass on, a lot of what we do, even at the federal level, starts with our state and local partners. So as we get information, that allows us the ability to start working those cases up and the tip information that we get.
I think we may have been having some trouble with your microphone on that. Mike, let me come back to you. Have we made any progress to address the cartels that are bringing this in?
Oh, absolutely. We're working each and every day, and we're coordinating cases with the United States Attorney's Office, and we're absolutely making progress with it. But it's like anything. Until we get the southwest border situated, they're very creative to find ways to bring the drugs into the country, and they're just peddling poison. So all we can do is continue to work the cases like we're working, continue to coordinate, and continue to make arrests.
We're talking about the resurgence, although it could be argued that it never really went away, of methamphetamine in Indiana with Michael Gannon from the DEA and Dan Gordon from the High-Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program. If you have any questions for our panel, you can send them to us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana, or you can give us a call and leave a voicemail at 866-476-3881, and we'll try to get it in front of Mike and Dan in the next 5 minutes that we have. I'm wondering how much of a challenge it is to get information on drugs coming in from another country. Can we identify? I mean, is it pretty easy to tell or assume that everything that's meth-related in Indiana is coming from Mexico?
I mean, you can assume at probably a 90-95% rate. No question about it. It's coming from Mexico.
Dan, how many meth labs have we seen in Indiana in the last, say, couple of years?
Yeah, there may be a couple of handfuls here. That's really dropped off. We no longer see the what they used to refer to as one pots or meths in these rural areas. Smaller labs, hotel rooms, cars, things like that. You really just don't see it anymore because, again, the amount of methamphetamine coming in from Mexico is there's so much of it. It's more potent, and obviously it's very cheap.
Has that affected the way that you approach it? Are you do you have anyone really looking for that anymore?
No, I mean, look, we still, as I mentioned earlier, still respond to an awful lot of tips that roll in. Through our state and local partners as well as to DEA. But I don't think we look at it any different. Again, we just don't see as much of the small labs that we used to, say, 10 years ago.
But Matt, another thing that's important too, when you talked about some of the information that we get, for us, you just never know where a case can go. And you never know the one guy that provides information to you. It's almost like when you start an investigation, you may not be dealing with the kingpin, but you might be a few people removed from just a unique situation in an investigation where you're targeting someone. Next thing you know, you're right into a source from another country. So that's important stuff. So intelligence is important. Getting together with our local counterparts is important. But at the end of the day, too, people have to be – we have to work on educating people. We have to, you know, encourage people to not use methamphetamine and ask why are they using it in the first place when you know it can rot your teeth out. You know, and when people use it, they're having issues where they think bugs are crawling inside their skin and they're scratching themselves. And I realize that it releases a lot of dopamine in your brain and everything like that. But the point is we need to try to get people from running away from methamphetamine instead of looking to purchase it and use it.
Mm-hmm. Does the way you approach meth differ from, say, the way you approach opioids or another kind of drug, or you're just trying to track the source?
Well, it's like any investigation that you work. You're going to do what we do. We're going to get together as a team. We're going to initiate a plan, and we're going to see what the person's distributed and how we can track down their organization and try to do the best thing that we can to infiltrate it. You know, sometimes if you're working opioid investigations, you may be working with pharmacies or doctor's office if you're working that type of case. Here we're working people that are putting methamphetamine on the streets. So it's a little bit of a different trafficker, that's all. But it's like anything. We use the same investigative techniques that we'd use in any case.
I want to get to Matt's question on Twitter, rather his comment. He says, many parts of the state are economically depressed with few opportunities to get ahead. It seems to me like an explanation of the drug problems that we're having right now. But these drug problems, have you seen them sort of getting worse, or does it just kind of the picture changes, I guess? Dan?
No, I think that's a good way to describe it. It just kind of changes a little bit. I don't know that it's worse right now. We've got a problem. There's no doubt about it. And we're trying to do everything we can to address it. I don't think the rural areas are any different. Obviously, it's more prevalent in the urban areas, but it's an issue.
Do you hear that a lot, though, these sort of explanations as to why drugs are a problem? And then from where you sit, do you have any sort of counter to that? Do you kind of think in the back of your head, well, it's always a problem and we're doing our best to fix it?
You know, it's a holistic approach. Our side is obviously mainly geared towards enforcement, but it boils down to, education when they're younger, to choices they make, through adolescence and that. So I don't think any particular area is any more susceptible than others.
I think also, too, to add to your point, Matt, any type of drug that alters your mind or has potential for addiction, it's a problem. And we need to make sure as a community and a society we're trying to encourage people to avoid using any drug because it's a path that leads down a slippery slope for some people. And the addiction overcomes them and takes over their life.
Michael Gannon, Assistant Special Agent for the Drug Enforcement Administration, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Gordon, Group Supervisor for the High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Program. Thanks for taking the time, Dan.
Thank you, Matt.
Coming up next, we're going to close out the show with a recent conversation I had with Ball State journalism professor Natalie Seeley on trauma journalism and whether or not some journalists are reporting symptoms of PTSD from the crime beat and other related areas of expertise. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds with that. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. One of the more stressful jobs out there is the job of a journalist. And by no means am I tooting my own horn here. Where I spend my day in either an office or a studio, reporters are out there in the field gathering the story where it happened, all the way down to the sometimes literally gory details. Ball State journalism professor Natalie Seeley used to be a crime reporter and saw her fair share of trauma. She decided to look at the effects of trauma on newspaper reporters. She spoke with over 250 of them, and her study was published in the Newspaper Research Journal. Natalie Seeley, welcome to All In.
Hi, thanks for inviting me on.
I want to talk about the study. You tracked down some very interesting data, but let's start, if we can, with an example from your own career as a reporter. Is there a particular story that you covered that you can say now had a strong effect on your mental health?
You know, I think that the most memorable moment for me when I first started was actually my very first day on the job. I have a pretty interesting story. So I was fresh out of college. This was my first journalism job. I was told I would be covering the crime beat. My first day, about an hour before I was about to clock out, it was about 11 p.m., got a call over the police scanner, and there was a drunk driving accident just two blocks away from the newspaper office. So I walked down there, and the first thing I saw was a body draped over a guardrail. And that was on my first night as a reporter. So that image has really stuck with me over the years, and it really made me realize how unprepared in many ways I was coming into this career.
And not just you. I mean, isn't the crime beat assigned to a lot of new reporters?
It is. Traditionally, it is. You graduate from college. Maybe you want to cover fashion. Maybe you want to cover science. But you oftentimes your first job is not your dream job. So you have to do what's needed. And the general assignment beat or the crime beat is very often what is assigned to new reporters. And with the news industry landscape changing so rapidly, there are fewer reporters covering more beats. So you're more likely going to be covering some kind of crime news if you are a journalist working for a news outlet.
And so this is often the first step for a new journalist, and is that just because it's not a very easy beat to cover, and so the seasoned journalists feel like they've put in their time and they don't have to do that anymore?
That's interesting. You said putting in their time. When I interviewed journalists for my study, several of them referred to covering crime as doing their time. Many of them described it as being thrown into the deep end. So they use these phrases that really described the crime beat as, you know, something they necessarily didn't want to do, but, you know, they had to do in order to get where they were, you know, to do the beats that they really wanted to do. So, yeah, I mean, I don't really know the reasons why the crime beat is the first one assigned, but I think it has to do with the fact that it's not a very desirable beat for a lot of reporters.
And so for this study, you surveyed 254 newspaper reporters nationwide. What did you find?
Well, I found several interesting things. A lot of researchers have studied the effects of large-scale catastrophes on reporters' mental health, things like 9/11, Hurricane Katrina, war reporting. But I wanted to measure how frequently reporters were covering trauma in general in their everyday beats. What I found was that journalists who covered trauma more often reported higher rates of PTSD symptoms than those who covered trauma less often. Now, I'm not a medical doctor, so I can't diagnose PTSD, but I can measure the ingredients of PTSD. So things like negative cognitions like depression or guilt or having flashbacks. I measured all of these things, and I found a significant relationship between covering trauma more frequently and experiencing these symptoms.
And so, like, what were the numbers? How many reporters were saying that they were reporting these sort of symptoms that you'll find?
Many of them did, and I don't have the specific percentages, but according to the analysis, the relationship was significant, and that means that it was not just by chance that these journalists reported higher rates of PTSD symptoms. But what was more interesting was the interviews that I did. Nearly all of the journalists I spoke to about 28 journalists who were interested in doing an in-depth interview. And, you know, the way they described their experiences covering trauma was so interesting, and it really made me realize that a lot of these journalists don't have a lot of people to talk to about their experiences on the job. And so that was a much more nuanced information that added a lot to the study, was getting those in-depth interviews and talking about those personal experiences.
And the sample that you were working with, or are you talking to mostly new journalists, or did it kind of run the gamut of experience level?
It ran the gamut. Yeah, it ran the gamut. I had many veteran reporters, probably about 20 to 30 reporters who had more than 25 years of experience. And I would say more than half of reporters had about 10 to 15 years of experience. And then I had, you know, the rest were probably between 5 to 10 years of experience. So really, these were reporters from all different backgrounds, male and female, who had either just started, I think the newest reporter I spoke to had just started a few months before, and then I spoke to another reporter who had more than 35 years of experience.
Wow. And so getting into the in-depth interviews, what were some of the surprising things that you found when you got to talk to those 28 who agreed to sit down with you?
I wanted to know about their coping mechanisms. I wanted to know how journalists were dealing with on-the-job trauma. And many of them opened up to me about the fact that they didn't really have many healthy coping mechanisms. Some of them drank a lot of alcohol. Some of them abused prescription drugs. Some of them compartmentalized, which compartmentalizing is when you sort of hold back your emotions, which can be an effective strategy if you do it correctly. But if you don't, that can actually be unhealthy. Other people I spoke to did have some healthy outlets. They spoke with their spouses. They spoke with their editors and colleagues. They exercised. They binge-watched Netflix. They did crafts. They did yoga. And a lot of them told me that just the act of writing the stories was a cathartic experience that sort of helped them get through it. And many of them mentioned the fact that their role as a reporter was so important to society that that thought helped them get through those challenging stories, just knowing that they were providing a public service.
Well, and I would imagine that the less experience a journalist has, the less prepared they are also to not only handle the situation, but to treat the real victims they need to interview with the level of respect and tact that they kind of need to not only do their own job well, the reporters, but also to be respectful of those people on what's essentially the worst day of their life.
Absolutely.
And I would imagine that treating any of those situations incorrectly in retrospect could haunt a reporter for years.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one thing that's lacking in journalism education is best practices for how to approach a trauma victim who, like you said, probably just had the worst day of his or her life. And, you know, re-traumatizing that person by approaching the interview in the wrong way not only hurts the person you're interviewing, but it can hurt the journalist too, because many of them feel totally unprepared to interview these victims. So there is a responsibility to be sensitive, do your job, but be sensitive and understand how trauma affects people so that you can conduct a good interview. Because I think when you do the interview correctly, you get a great story. And a lot of victims want to tell their story, but it has to be done the right way. And I think that's one thing that journalism programs could be doing a better job at teaching student journalists.
And again, what's important to note about your study is that you're talking to crime reporters, beat reporters, everyday journalists, not embedded war reporters. And again, we kind of mentioned this earlier, and we're not talking about people who have covered a particularly high amount of, say, natural disasters or terrorist attacks or anything like that. Did the results of these sort of everyday working stiff reporters, did that surprise you at all?
It didn't surprise me. I sort of refer to all of the everyday trauma that journalists cover as micro traumas. You know, a lot of these reporters were covering, right, they weren't covering, you know, mass disasters. I mean, some of them did. Some of them had covered some mass shootings, and I'm sure they were awful. But a lot of these reporters were covering car accidents every day that maybe involved children. Or some reporters were covering domestic abuse or suicides, drug abuse, harassment, sexual assault. So these sort of traumas that you wouldn't necessarily see as catastrophes, but doing it every day, every single day of their job. And those things really just add up, and they can have this cumulative effect on mental health.
And how journalists are perceived by the public may be at least a small part of the issue here. How do non-journalists see reporters?
I think there is a tendency to view reporters as superhuman. They are not affected by their work. They are completely objective and they don't let anything get to them. I think that's just sort of this societal perception. And that's very much a myth. And it's true that journalists are a resilient group. But they are also a vulnerable group because of problems with newsroom culture and a lack of education and a lack of trauma training in newsrooms. When you work for a fire department or a police department, you are required to undergo training and you often undergo debriefings after a particularly tragic case. Journalists are not expected or required to do that. And yet they are very much like first responders. So I think that there needs to be more understanding and more awareness and more resources available to journalists in newsrooms.
Well, do you think, though, that journalists may play some kind of a part in that? I mean, it's such a competitive field, and I would imagine a lot of reporters don't want to admit much vulnerability.
Absolutely. Yeah, a lot of journalists who I spoke to for this study said that they didn't really talk about it a lot in their newsroom. If a story was causing them any trouble, or if they were feeling any negative mental health effects or feeling vulnerable or feeling depressed about an assignment, a lot of them didn't want to talk to their colleagues or editors about it because they were worried that they would be assigned to a different beat, taken off the story, or perceived as incompetent or not good enough for that job by their superiors and their colleagues. So there is this sort of stigma in newsrooms. People don't want to talk about feeling upset. They don't want to talk about their mental health because they're worried about what effects that might have on their job and the way they're perceived.
Most people think of first responders, police, fire, EMTs, as being the people who bear the brunt of these sort of secondary psychological traumas. But I think what you're saying is that often those first responders have training that help them deal with that, whereas journalists often don't.
Absolutely. And I think some newsrooms are getting better at this, especially newsrooms that are larger, but smaller newspapers, community newspapers, they just don't have the resources to offer training. And, you know, some of the reporters I talked to said that in their health insurance plan, there was a stipulation that they could have one free counseling session a month. But this was never advertised. It was in the fine print. It was never talked about. Many of them said that after a particularly tragic story, they were never talked to about, you know, how they should cope with this. So I think that some of the resources are there, but they just need to be brought to light.
What are some of the basic principles of trauma preparedness or trauma literacy? What should an adequately prepared journalist know going into a potentially traumatic scene?
I think they need to know that they need to be sensitive with victims. They need to understand how to approach them, what questions to ask, and how to ask them. They also need to understand that trauma affects everyone differently, and it will affect them as well. So they shouldn't go into a story thinking that they are superhuman. They should realize that traumatic effects are real and that they should be able to cope with them in a healthy way. Find some outlet, some healthy way to deal with the after effects of covering challenging stories on the job. And don't be afraid to speak to your editor about mental health. I think that the more it is talked about in newsrooms, that stigma will disappear the more it's talked about.
And is trauma literacy with respect to journalism being taught there at Ball State?
I think it is, yes. And I teach media law at Ball State, and we always have a section on trauma literacy, how to approach victims. We incorporate a lot of materials from the DART Center for Journalism and Trauma. We talk about how to approach victims, and we talk a little bit about my research, too. A lot of the students don't have any experience with crime reporting, and a lot of the journalists I spoke to for my study said that trauma reporting in general and mental health in general were just never discussed in their education. So I think if we can start early and just get these students more prepared, help them understand that trauma could affect them in these negative ways, that's our best shot at fostering a healthy workforce.
Have you or any of your colleagues been approached by former students who have personally been having trouble with this?
I have not. I've been at Ball State for about 2.5 years, so many of my students are still there, or they just now got their first jobs. So I have not yet had experiences like that, but I would not be surprised if I do.
And is this study over? Do you plan to follow it up with anything?
Yes. Right now I'm working on another study that's very similar to the work that I did a couple of years ago, but I'm going to be interviewing and surveying TV anchors. For the study that we've been talking about, I surveyed newspaper journalists, but now I want to look at the effects of trauma on TV anchors, which have different job responsibilities, and they're often very up close and personal. They're also interviewing victims on camera many times. So I'd like to talk to them, which is another important segment of the journalism workforce.
Well, when you get your results, we'd love to follow up as well. Ball State Journalism Professor Natalie Seeley, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. And our podcast will be up later this afternoon wherever you get podcasts. Check that out. Dig into our archives to see if there's anything we've talked about before that piques your interest. And be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're talking about. Join us tomorrow when we'll speak with local filmmakers involved in a project with Indiana Humanities called Inseparable, which highlights short documentaries focused on the divides as well as common ground between urban and rural Indiana. Hear that at this time tomorrow. Of course, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana for daily topic alerts and conversation on the issues you care about. And keep up on the latest state news by following Indiana Public Broadcasting at IPBS_news. I'm Matt Pelser, and I'm at Matt Pelser on Twitter as well. Thanks for listening. This is All In.